Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples, which we already covered in the prefaces. Today we're going to do Chapter 2, Genetic Segregation of Jews and Gentiles. It's comparatively short, so it won't take all that long. So let's dig in. Chapter 2, Genetic Segregation of Jews and Gentiles. Starts with a block quote. The Israelite marries only another Israelite. Foreign elements do not intermingle with them. That's a medieval Islamic author, Al-Jahiz, J-A-H-I-Z, reprinted in Stillman, 1979, 170. So even long ago, they were observing that they don't marry with other peoples. In another epigraph, I live not far from the city of Worms, to which I am bound by the tradition of my forefathers, and from time to time I go there. I go over to the Jewish cemetery, consisting of crooked, cracked, shapeless, random stones. The dust is there, no matter how thinly scattered. There lies the corporeality of man. I have stood in the dust and through it with the patriarchs. That's Martin Buber, B-U-B-E-R, 1933, quoted in Margalit, 1993-69. Subtitle, The Segregation of the Jewish Gene Pool. The thesis that Judaism is an evolutionary strategy does not rely on the proposition that Jews represent a distinct race. As we heard last time, you can have a group strategy and your group can be open to admixture or it can be closed to it. So it's not a racial theory per se, or it doesn't depend on it, he's saying. The minimal requirement for the present theory of Judaism as a fairly closed group strategy is that there be genetic gradients, and that's the word he uses over and over and over, genetic gradient between well-defined groups of Jews and Gentiles within particular societies that are maintained by cultural practices. So they have a history of endogamy, or breeding among themselves and not mixing. That's their culture. And so you have a fairly, as he's saying, well-defined groups of Jews and Gentiles in a particular society. And that difference is maintained by cultural practices. It is the genetic gradient and the coincident competition between significantly different gene pools that are of interest to the evolutionist. Clearly, such a proposal is compatible with some genetic admixture from the surrounding populations. However, an evolutionary perspective must also consider the hypothesis that widely dispersed Jewish populations have significantly more genetic commonality than local Jewish populations have with their Gentile cohabitants, since this hypothesis is relevant to developing an evolutionary theory of the patterns of altruism and cooperation among widely scattered Jewish populations. So he's saying it would be bad for the theory if these Jews are all spread out. Now, if each of the little groups of them were widely different from themselves, that would cause problems for the theory, but we know already that they're not, that they are similar. Jews are more similar to Jews far away than they are to Goyim close by. It should be noted at the outset that there are good reasons to suppose that there will be some differentiation of the Jewish gene pool among the different Jewish groups of the diaspora. These groups were separated, in many cases for two millennia or more, so that even in the absence of genetic admixture with surrounding populations, one would expect that genetic drift, as well as natural selection, resulting, for example, from differences in climate or parasites, would begin to differentiate these populations genetically. So even if you interbreed, if you're part of groups that are living in different places, that's going to tell over time. Regarding genetic drift, the high frequencies of recessive disorders among Jewish populations, and the fact that recessive disorders tend to be unique to particular communities, strongly suggest that Jewish populations have been susceptible to founder effects and genetic drift, basically related to inbreeding. Chase and McCusick, 1972, Fracor, 1977, Morant, Kopech, and Domaniuska, Sobchak, 1978. The general picture is that Jewish communities often originated with a very few families who married within the group, typically with high levels of inbreeding. So whatever genetic mix they had, the bad part is going to keep showing up and probably get worse from the inbreeding. See chapters 4 and 8. There is also evidence that selection within the diaspora environment has been an important in differentiating Jewish populations. Selection within the diaspora. Thus, Motulski, 1977b, 425, proposes that, given the clear evidence for the genetic distinctiveness of the Ashkenazi gene pool, the resemblance in physical characteristics and the ABO blood group between the Ashkenazim and the Gentile European population is due to convergent selection. See also below. Lenz, 1931, 667, 668, Lenz suggests that the phenotypic resemblance of Jews to the local Gentile population may arise from natural and sexual selection for individuals who resembled the local population, just as different species of butterflies may come to resemble each other. They start to look like the goyim they live around. It is thus theoretically possible that a fairly small set of genes promoting phenotypic similarity, look similarity, could be amplified via natural selection within Jewish populations without precluding a large overall genetic distance between Jewish and Gentile gene pools. Now, how exactly would that work? That seems a little odd. So we're keeping our genes, but we're going to make ourselves look more like you to fool you more. That doesn't seem very easy. Selective processes within far-flung Jewish communities might also lead to genetic divergence between them. For example, in Chapter 7, data are discussed indicating a great deal of assortative mating. Another key thing, assortative means you group with people you like, you know, like looking for high IQ people tend to marry other high IQ people. That's assortative or assortative mating for traits related to intelligence, high investment parenting, and group cohesion within Jewish communities. So they're looking, we want to have a few kids, but they're going to be bright. We're going to put a lot of money into them and educate them and really teach them to be part of our group. That's how Jews do it. That's their strategy. Although eugenic selection for a common phenotype may result in selection for the same genes, this certainly need not be the case, since different Jewish populations may accrue different genetic mutations related to intelligence, as well as different genes resulting from low levels of genetic admixture with local Gentile populations. Supporting this possibility, Eldridge, 1970, see also Eldridge and Kerber, 1977, suggests that a gene causing primary torsion dystonia, which occurs at high levels among Ashkenazi Jews, may have a heterozygote advantage because of beneficial effects on intelligence. So again, you have the two sides of the coin. They may have a gene for high IQ, but it's tied to a disease gene as well. Further supporting the importance of selective processes, 8 of the 11 genetic diseases found predominantly among Ashkenazi Jews, so there are 11 genetic diseases found predominantly among Ashkenazi Jews. Remember, Ashkenazi is the Yiddish, which is German, Yiddish, Jewish, Jewish in English, Yiddish in German, and Yiddish, the language. Yiddish comes from Yiddish, which is German, or Jewish in English. Ashkenazi means Poland. So that's where all the Ashkenazis really, really metastasized like a tumor, grew in hugely in numbers, was in Poland, their first golden age and golden place. And so he's saying there's 11 genetic diseases among Ashkenazis. Eight of them involve the central nervous system. And 3 are closely related in their biochemical effects. So 11 genetic diseases among Ashkenazi Jews. C. Goodman, 1979, 463, footnote 1. Thus, and that's McDonald's footnote 1. Thus, there is no expectation that the various populations of diaspora Judaism will remain genetically uniform. Moreover, the possibilities of natural selection and drift suggest that the most important confirmatory data for the present evolutionary hypothesis are positive indications of genetic commonality between separated Jewish groups, combined with differences from cohabitant populations, show that they're like themselves over different areas and they're not like the locals. Thus, if in fact gene frequency data for some loci, those are centers, that's the plural of locus. Locus is a center of something. Loci, or loci is, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but that would be plural locuses. Thus, if in fact gene frequency data for some loci fail to support the genetic segregation hypothesis, such findings are less important than the findings that many other genetic systems and morphological traits, morph means the form of something, do fit the hypothesis. E.g., Kobe Liansky et al., 1982. Despite these caveats, there is overwhelming evidence for the proposition that the Jewish gene pool has been significantly segregated from the gene pools of the populations that Jews have lived among for centuries, while at the same time there is significant genetic commonality between Jewish groups that have been separated for centuries. So it's very clear there is overwhelming evidence that Jews are marrying Jews and not mixing with the local Goyim. That's the point. Footnote 2. Millay and Kobe Liansky, 1985, using dermatoglyphic data, I'm not sure what that is, skin writing by the origin, dermatoglyphic, derma, skin, glyphic, writing, have found that Eastern European Jews are far more similar to North African and Middle Eastern Jews than to non-Jewish Eastern Europeans. So they're much more like some Jew running around in Tunisia than they are like the Pole who lives next door. Indeed, they are more similar to Caucasians from the Caucasus Mountains or Middle Asia than to Caucasians from Eastern Europe. Similarly, Sachs and Bat-Miriam, 1957, have found striking similarities among Jews from 9 countries in Central Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East in various indices of fingerprint patterns, a phenotype that is largely under genetic control. These similarities are accompanied by striking differences between Jews and non-Jews in all of these countries in North America, while at the same time Jews are much more similar to non-Jewish groups from the Eastern Mediterranean region, e.g. the Egyptian Copts and Israeli Arabs, than they are to non-Jewish groups from other parts of the world. So the Jews are more like the Palestinians and Saudi Arabians than they are like Europeans, because that's where they came from, and then they're much more like themselves than non-Jews. Quote, even Jews living in Europe and North America therefore show clear evidence of what one may call their original Eastern Mediterranean gene pool, despite, quote, being widely dispersed for centuries in different parts of the world, page 125. So, Jews are related to other Jews, and to a lesser extent to the people in the Eastern Mediterranean, and pretty much not at all to the whites they've lived among, is the key takeaway there. Sofair, Smith, and Kay, S-O-F-A-E-R, 1986, have found greater similarity in dental morphology, tooth shape, among 3 widely scattered, long-separated Jewish groups from Eastern Europe, Morocco, and Kurdish Iraq, than among 5 non-Jewish groups living relatively near them. Moreover, a 3,000-year-old Jewish skeletal group is more similar to these 3 Jewish groups than to all but 1 non-Jewish group studied. The Druze, a sect derived from Arabs in the 11th century, clustered with the Jewish groups. In another study, using cluster analysis on 25 morphological characteristics, again, form, the form something takes, morph, Kobe Liansky and Livschitz, such lovely names these Jews have, 1985, have found that Jewish groups from the USSR are 6 times more distant from the Russian group than the Russians are from the German group. In addition, Jews are completely separate from 24 ethnic groups living in Russia, Poland, and Germany, completely separate from 24 ethnic groups. Moreover, this divergence in morphology is highly correlated with divergence in biochemical characteristics based on the data of Kobylianski and his colleagues, 1982. Several studies of genetic distance between Jews and non-Jews have been performed using blood group data. Carlin, Kennett, and Bonnet-Tamir, 1979, see also Bonnet-Tamir, hyphen, Ashbell and Kennett, 1977, using 14 polymorphic loci, have found no significant differences among Jews from Libya, Iraq, Germany, Poland, and Russia. No significant differences. Think about that, how different those places are. Russia, Poland, Germany, Iraq, Libya, and they find no significant differences among Jews. However, all of these Jewish populations are significantly separated from Arabs, Germans, and Armenians. The distance between Jewish and non-Jewish populations living in the same area is 3 to 5 times greater than the distances between several Ashkenazi groups. Bonnet-Tamir and his colleagues, 1977-75, conclude, quote, "Not much admixture has taken place between Ashkenazi Jews and their Gentile neighbors during the last 700 years or so." Similarly, Kobylianski and his colleagues, 1982, have calculated genetic distance on the basis of 13 blood polymorphisms from 6 Jewish groups originating in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Southern Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, and Yemen, and have compared them with those of non-Jews from the same areas. Small differences were found among the Jewish populations in the direction of the frequencies of the non-Jewish populations of the same area. Cluster analysis revealed that all of the Jewish populations, except the Yemenite population, clustered together with a non-Jewish Middle Eastern population, while Eastern, Central, and Southern European non-Jews formed a second cluster, and the North African non-Jews formed a third cluster. So Europeans aren't like North Africans, and neither are like Jews, who are like themselves. Jews who remained in the Middle East retained greater similarity to the ancestral Jewish population than did the migrants. Morant, Kopek, and Domaniuska-Sobchak, 1979, conclude their very broad survey of blood group data of Jewish groups from Asia, Europe, and Africa by commenting that, quote, "It may be said that in general, blood group data support the relative homogeneity of the main historical Jewish communities and their distinctness from one another." Page 57. They find that neither the Ashkenazim nor the Sephardim closely resembled the populations they had resided among for centuries, and although there were a number of differences between these groups, overall the differences were so small that they conclude that Jews represent essentially a single population. So they have essentially kept their blood pure, as Disraeli talked about in Coningsby in his other book, his other novel. Similarly, Carmelli and Cavalli-Sforza, a big name among racialists, you used to hear about Cavalli hyphen Sforza, 1979, using a discriminant analysis based on 3 loci, have found that, with the exception of Jewish isolates, the centroids of all Jewish groups, including the Ashkenazians, the Sephardic Jews, are nearer the non-Jewish Middle Eastern centroid than the Southern or Central European centroids. So Jews are basically a Middle Eastern people, or he's saying Eastern Mediterranean people or Middle Eastern. Roy Choudhury, 1974, in a study based on results from 9 loci, has found Ashkenazi Jews and North African Jews to be more closely related to each other than to non-Jewish Europeans and North Africans, respectively. Finally, Seinberg, Zeinberg, 1977, characterizes data on fingerprint patterns and polymorphic blood proteins as indicating general similarities among Ashkenazi Jews, non-Ashkenazi Jews, and non-Jewish Mediterranean peoples, but as indicating differences between these groups and Western, Central, and Eastern European populations. Kobe Liansky and his colleagues, 1982, have also found evidence that some of the divergence of Jewish gene frequencies is due to selection in the diaspora environment, since in the case of Yemenite Jews, while there are major differences in frequency for several loci, and others, the Jewish groups are relatively similar to the local populations. This suggests that selection has occurred at some loci in the direction of a greater similarity to the local population, but significant admixture is counterindicated because other major differences between Jews and non-Jews remain on the loci. Loci are these different individual hot spots where Jews are located. Other investigators have found a similar pattern. Thus, Bane Tamir, Ashbel, and Kennett, 1977, have found little difference between Jews and non-Jews in the ABO system, while, for example, the RH system shows a major difference, and Zeinberg, 1977, has found that the PGM blood group system among Ashkenazi Jews is quite similar to that found in European populations. Thus, while some natural selection in the direction of European populations may have occurred among the Ashkenazim, there is little evidence for admixture, a conclusion also reached by Cavalli-Sforza and Carmelli in 1977. I conclude, says McDonald, that these studies of genetic distance point to the common genetic origins of all of the Jewish populations of the world. All of them. Common genetic origins. E.g. Kobe Liansky et al., 1982. They also indicate that, although there is some genetic admixture with surrounding populations as well as some natural selection toward the frequencies of local populations, all Jewish populations have a significant degree of segregation from native populations. All Jewish populations are not like the ones they're living around. And a significant degree of commonality with other Jewish groups derived from widely separated parts of the world. Finally, the data support the proposal that, with the exception of non-Jewish Middle Eastern populations, all Jewish groups are more closely related to each other than to any non-Jewish group. So Jews exist, they're not in one place, they're spread out all over the world, and all the scientific research that has been done shows that they are more closely related to their own kind spread out around the world than they are to the locals. That's really all this amounts to in this first part of it. We're on page 40 going up to 49. Gentile representation in the Jewish gene pool is the next subtitle. And then we'll just have conclusion and notes. So really only a couple of subtitles in this chapter. Pretty short chapter. It just shows that first we proved Jews are segregated. Now we're going to talk about to what extent are Gentiles in the Jewish gene pool. Gentile representation in the Jewish gene pool. We have seen that Jewish populations tend to resemble local populations to some extent genetically. Although these findings could be due to selection in the diaspora environment, they are also compatible with the possibility of some gene flow between populations. Indeed, it would be rather remarkable if there was no gene flow at all into the Jewish gene pool from Gentile populations living in close proximity over several centuries. The data reviewed in Chapter 4, and we're in Chapter 2 now, indicate that, in fact, there have been low levels of Gentile proselytism to Judaism over the centuries, and Patai and Patai, P-A-T-A-I, 1989, suggests that the rape of Jewish women by Gentiles, as well as the illicit affairs of Jewish women with Gentile men, may also have influenced the representation of Gentile genes in the Jewish gene pool. It is possible that even this relatively small genetic admixture from surrounding populations could be adaptive for a strategizing group, because the group would benefit from new genetic combinations. For example, genes related to intellectual abilities occurring in Gentile populations could enter the Jewish gene pool even with very low levels of intermixing. You know, if they just marry a few of the really smart or really good-looking goyim, they can steal, like, look how they marry into Trump. They acquire his drive, his energy, his vigor, his money, and his looks, and add that to their group. If they do it in small enough numbers, over time they can more or less retain their distinctiveness. These genes could then be propagated within the Jewish community via Jewish eugenic practices, for which there is substantial evidence, see Chapter 7, and other sources of natural selection, because they enhance the competitive abilities of those bearing the genes, while Gentile-derived genes, which conferred no such advantage, would be allowed to drift or could actually be selected against. The overall result would be that only a relatively few Gentile genes would enter the Jewish population, so that the basic genetic rationale of Judaism as a fairly closed evolutionary strategy would not be significantly compromised. So they want to get the best and get rid of the other stuff. Moreover, even though some Gentile-derived genes were being selected for their effects on resource-obtaining abilities within the Jewish community, the Gentile-derived genes may also have pleiotropic effects that would result in greater phenotypic similarity between genes and Jews and Gentiles. Let's look that up. I don't know what that means, pleiotropic. Okay, pleiotropy, this is actually fairly important. Pleiotropy, tropy means a movement toward, basically, but pleiotropy occurs when one gene influences two or more seemingly unrelated phenotypic traits. A pleiotropic gene is a single gene that controls more than one trait. Genes that affect multiple apparently unrelated phenotypes are thus called pleiotropic genes. So a gene that has almost hidden or multiple effects on other on traits. So let's see. Moreover, even though some Gentile-derived genes were being selected for their effects on the resource-obtaining abilities within the Jewish community, the Gentile-derived genes may also have had pleiotropic effects, like influenced other genes, that would result in greater phenotypic similarity between Jews and Gentiles, like they got something good, but also it changed their looks a little to help them fit in more, I guess he's saying. Evidence in favor of this hypothesis would be that Jewish proselytism, while highly limited and restricted, has been far more successful among wealthy, intelligent, and talented individuals, and that this pattern was actively encouraged by the Jewish community. Say someone like Scarlett Johansson, who's like half Jew, you start to bring in the good looks, or non-Semitic looks that allow you to blend in or be perceived not only as more Gentile-looking, but more attractive among the Gentile looks. So you still retain the Jewish basis, but you add, you start to move away from the hook nose hand rubbing swarthiness. Accounts of proselytes, see e.g. Patai and Patai 1989, indicate that proselytism was more common among talented and wealthy people, like, you know, Ivanka Trump. For example, Patai and Patai, in describing proselytes in Germany, note that once again, history records only the conversions of those few proselytes in Germany who were exceptional among the many converts to Judaism because they were of high status in Gentile society prior to their conversion, or because they had achieved renown after they had become Jewish. The finding that converts are disproportionately intelligent and successful may be the result of biased reporting, as suggested by Patai and Patai, 1989, but there is no actual evidence that this is the case. The actual historical record, therefore, is highly consistent with the hypothesis that converts have been disproportionately wealthy, talented individuals, but there may indeed be some underreporting of the poor and obscure. I think I knew when I worked in D.C., I knew we had a IT guy at the place who was a Jew, and he married a very, very goyish white woman, very pleasant personality from, he was very abrasive, and she was very pleasant, accommodating type from, like, West Virginia. Complete opposites. I don't know if she converted, but she might have. But that would be bringing some different looks, but different personality type into Jews. But that's pretty rare. However, besides actual data on the conversions of the poor and obscure, there are excellent reasons for supposing that, in fact, Jewish proselytes would tend disproportionately to be intelligent and successful. There is overwhelming evidence for the existence of an extremely strong emphasis on the establishment of an elite characterized by high intelligence and resource control within the Jewish communities of the diaspora throughout Jewish history. See chapter 6 and 7. So they know where the deal is decided. They know what matters. They know what's going to lead you to get ahead, and they're very focused on it. Given this strong bias, it is highly unlikely that poor and obscure Gentiles would be interested in joining the Jewish community, where they would be at considerable reproductive disadvantage. Nor is it likely that historical Jewish communities would have welcomed such individuals. They don't want a bunch of poor, stupid Gentile bums. There is no question that poor and uneducated Gentiles would be relegated to a very low social status as proselytes in the Jewish community, and every reason to suppose that such individuals would not have been welcomed by the Jewish community. Consistent with this proposal, of the 8 Gentile proselytes found by Simon, 1986, 279 to 280, in the period from AD 135 to the end of the 4th century, 7 were scholars. Moreover, as might be expected, given the strong emphasis on elitism within the Jewish community, there is evidence that Jewish apostates, ones who left Judaism, tended disproportionately to be poor and obscure Jews, at least into the 19th century. Leah, 1906, 07, 1, 111, 139. Leah notes that prior to the forced conversions of 1391 in Spain, the converts to Christianity had been mostly of humble status, and prior to the expulsion of 1492, only the lowest classes of the remaining Jews converted to Christianity. Footnote 3. Similarly, Weinrib, R-Y-B, 1972-94, notes that although voluntary conversions of Jews to Christianity in traditional Poland were small in number, they mostly involved poor and obscure Jews. Moreover, Kaplan, 1983-275, shows that poor Jewish girls who could not afford an adequate dowry were forced to marry Gentiles as a last resort. Poulan, 1983-294 FF, so the Goyim get the worst of the Jews. The Jews steal off some of the better Goyim. So that Jews are constantly becoming better, finer, and higher, and the Goyim are just going the opposite way. So they're keeping their advantage, and they're trying to build on it as best they can. Poulan, 1983, 294 FF, finds 12 cases of Jewish apostasy in 16th century Venice, of whom 9 were poor Jews attempting to better their economic conditions. All 3 of the wealthy individuals apostatized in order to marry or have sexual intercourse with Gentile females and or obtain property. In at least 2 of the cases, the conversions themselves appear to have been insincere. This trend for apostates to be disproportionately of humble status was altered, beginning with a trend toward emancipation. That's Napoleon times, early 1800s. They were given citizenship. But the reverse trend did not occur even then. During this period, Jewish apostates included many individuals hoping to advance their career options, but, as Katz points out, the apostates did not differ economically or in terms of education or social success from those who remained Jews. If, in fact, poor and obscure Jews were disproportionately abandoning Judaism, there is no reason whatever to suppose that poor and obscure Gentiles were even proportionally represented as proselytes to Judaism. Similarly, recent surveys in the United States indicate that more highly educated Jews and those with higher socioeconomic status are more likely to marry endogamously, Elman 1987, again suggesting a greater identification with Judaism among elite individuals. These findings are highly compatible with the idea that the few proselytes in traditional societies who did convert to Judaism were in fact disproportionately drawn from among the talented, educated, and wealthy. Besides low levels of proselytism on the part of disproportionately wealthy and intelligent Gentiles, another reason for some Gentile penetration into the Jewish gene pool could be that Gentile genetic admixture may have resulted from behavior that was adapted to individual Jews, but that actually conflicted with Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. From an evolutionary perspective, it is not in the least surprising that there are conflicts between group and individual interests, and in the case of Judaism, that individual Jews may attempt to contravene the group strategy and engage in behavior that is forbidden by the community. Footnote 4. So there are conflicts, and sometimes the individual wins out, but generally the group has won through Jewish history, or they wouldn't be around. Remember, they were one of hundreds of other groups that disappeared, so what they have does work. It requires a lot of social control and telling people constantly that you're Jews, here's what you are, everyone else hates you, stick together, look how great we are, we're vindicated by thousands of years of success. For example, a Jewish male without an heir by a Jewish woman may further his genetic interest by fathering children by Gentile women, e.g. slaves and concubines among the Sephardim in pre-expulsion Spain, or among Jews living in Muslim areas, and then scheming to get these children recognized as legitimate heirs. Or it may well be in the interest of the children themselves to become legitimate heirs and members of the Jewish community. There is historical evidence for such behavior. Patai and Patai, 1989, show that some concubine owners attempted to have their children by these women become their heirs. They suggest that the significant admixture of African genes among the Mzab Jews, M-Z-A-B, occurred because the male offspring of Jews and their slave girls may have had sexual relations with the master's wife. Similarly, it may have been in the interest of individual Jewish women to bear children who were illicitly conceived by Gentile men with attractive phenotypic or genetic traits. Such women could expect that their offspring would also have these traits, an aspect of female choice originally proposed by Darwin as an evolutionary mechanism. See discussion in MacDonald, 1991. It is interesting in this regard that in the Ottoman Jewish community, male vigilance of female behavior increased to truly obsessive proportions during a period of economic decline and intense persecution. Shaw, 1991, 137 FF. One might speculate that during periods of economic decline and intense persecution, there would be greater concern for defection of females from the group strategy and a greater attraction to Gentile males. Community control over female behavior during this period was truly remarkable. For example, women were expected to be extremely deferential toward men, and they were not allowed to leave their homes to shop for food if they had a servant. If they did not have a servant, they were forced to conduct their purchases in the doorway of the shop so that they could be seen from the street. So they exercise great control over women because they know how to act if they're on their own. It may also have been in the interest of a woman to rear a child sired by a Gentile rapist. A Jewish woman would be behaving quite adaptively if she clandestinely rears the child of a Gentile rapist rather than accepting one of the alternatives, having no children at all or having herself and the child shunned by the community and rejected by her husband. Such a woman is certainly deviating from the ideal of a closed group evolutionary strategy, but her behavior may be individually adaptive. Adaptive, just what gets you ahead or the group ahead. Successful is kind of another way. Patai and Patai, 1989, indicate that both illicit affairs and rape occurred among Jewish populations. Rape was probably fairly common in some eras, especially in Eastern Europe during the pogroms or war, such as the Cossack uprisings of the 17th century. Gretz, that's Heinrich Gretz, a famous Jewish historian, 1898-3-4041, recounts an incident in Roman times when German soldiers fathered children by Jewish prisoners of war. These individually adaptive behaviors must be viewed as events that, if they occurred sufficiently often, would have completely destroyed the genetic gradient separating Jewish and Gentile populations. So they occurred, but not that often, or the Jews wouldn't be distinct. Clearly, however, the level of influx was not sufficient to destroy the essential unity of the Jewish gene pool. Also, it is important to note that this genetic influx was illicit in the sense that it was not socially approved by the Jewish authorities themselves, and, as indicated in Chapter 4, there were active attempts to lower the social status of individuals with doubtful or alien parentage. Patai and Patai, 1988, 128, describe a Gaonic G-A-O-N-I-C, 8th, 9th century ruling, that a master having sexual relations with a slave was to be flogged, to be excommunicated for 30 days, and have his head shaved, the girl was to be sold and the money given to the poor. There were also repeated attempts by the Jewish religious authorities in Spain to completely end concubinage with Christian and Moorish women. See chapter 4. Moreover, beginning in the ancient world, Jewish religious ideology developed the belief that disguised bastards and their offspring would be removed from the Jewish population by dying young. Baron 1952b 222, footnote 5. To the extent that Jews believed their religious ideology and acted on it, and there is every effort to suppose this, or every reason to suppose this, to the extent that Jews believed their religious ideology and acted on it, such a belief would discourage such deceptive efforts. Such behavior is thus, quote, accidental from the standpoint of viewing Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy, in the sense that the great majority of this gene flow occurred as the result of individual behavior by Jews in contravention of religious law and the wishes of the community authorities. So there was some going on, but not much. And basically they are unified. It just proves his thesis, is what he's saying. Because it was illicit behavior, it would have remained secret, and this is undoubtedly the reason we know so little about it. And conclusion, and then just five notes. The most important conclusion is that the hypothesis of zero genetic differences between Jewish and Gentile populations is, on the basis of the above data, essentially unthinkable. And it must be remembered that even very shallow genetic gradients between groups are consistent with group strategizing, which would have important effects on gene frequencies. Virtually any group that segregates itself from another group is likely to vary genetically in some traits, if only because of the existence of random sampling effects. Thus, in D.S. Wilson's 1989 examples of a possible group structuring, it is theoretically possible for a subset of animals to separate themselves off from a larger group and pursue a group strategy. Such a group may have minimal genetic differences from the rest of the animals, but there would almost certainly be some genetic differences as a result of sampling effects. So whatever the native original population might have been like the rest, but it's always going to have some difference, and then that's quickly going to be worked on when it segregates or separates itself. That's genetic drift as well. These genetic differences from the original population may also involve traits that are important to following the group strategy. For example, in typical group selection models, the strategizing group is characterized by higher levels of altruism, and in the case of Judaism, it is suggested in Chapter 8 that Jews were predisposed to their particular evolutionary strategy because of their relatively high level of ethnocentrism. So they had the qualities that they put into their cultural model to start with. They just built on what they naturally had. Like someone might have a very strong arm and then subsequently build a culture of learning how to play football or baseball or something, a shortstop or a quarterback. So they were naturally... The people who started Judaism were like Jews are today. They had more of a natural basis for it. So they had a good basis. You say they're more than 90% of the population in the direction. Then they build a culture based on their difference. Moreover, there's the strong expectation that genetic divergence between the segregating groups would occur after separation due to differential processes of selection and drift acting on the two populations over time. Thus, even if there were almost no differences between the Jewish gene pool and the rest of the Near Eastern gene pool in, say, 586 BC, such differences would be expected to occur increasingly over time, resulting, among many other possible reasons, from the Jewish eugenic practices described in Chapter 7. Indeed, John Hartung, Personal Communication, August 28, 1992, has suggested that modern Jews are less closely related to the ancient Israelites than to modern Palestinians, an ironic possibility to say the least. Thus, Any maintenance of cultural segregation over long periods of historical time between groups that are in resource and reproductive competition with each other, whether intra-societal or inter-societal, is overwhelmingly likely to have evolutionary effects on gene frequencies in the population as a whole, and therefore be of evolutionary interest. And it is the nature of these cultural isolating mechanisms that is the focus of the following two chapters. How they build their culture, how they isolate it, develop it. Finally, although the data presented here indicate that Judaism is of importance to an evolutionist interested in interactions between different gene pools, there would be reason to pursue the present project even in the absence of genetic differences between Jews and Gentiles. So even if it weren't the case they're genetically different, it would still be important. The group dynamics, the group evolutionary strategy would still be significant and worth studying. This is because the evidence reviewed in the following chapters indicates that, in fact, the religious ideology and the behavior of Jews constituted a group evolutionary strategy as outlined in Chapter 1, with the exception that Judaism would not, in fact, be a fairly closed group evolutionary strategy if they were mixing with others. It would be more purely cultural. Even if, for example, Jewish communities in fact failed to control individually adaptive behavior so that the genetic gradient between Jews and Gentiles became non-existent, historic Judaism was a clearly articulated strategy in which there were great attempts to ensure compliance of all members of the Jewish community. If, in contradiction to all of the data presented in this chapter, the strategy nevertheless failed in genetic terms, it was a strategy nonetheless, and therefore worthy of investigation. Moreover, since evolutionary mechanisms may well function on the basis of phenotypic rather than genotypic cues, appearance rather than genes, even in the absence of genetic differences, one would still be justified in attempting to understand the remarkable phenomena of Judaism and anti-Semitism within an evolutionary framework. Two groups at odds, what is driving the one group and what is driving the response? And that's first is the subject of this book, and the next is the subject of his second book. That ends the chapter, and then we've just got the five notes. One, Motulski, 1977A, suggests that the higher incidence of myopia, nearsightedness, in Ashkenazi Jews could be the result of selection for higher verbal intelligence. Myopia and intelligence have been linked in other populations, and Jews tend to have higher intelligence and higher rates of myopia. Again, nearsightedness. Two, Patai and Patai, 1989, argue against this proposition, and such a proposition is incompatible with Arthur Koestler's hypothesis that Ashkenazi Jews are Caucasians who derive for the most part from the remnants of the Khazar Empire, which had converted to Judaism in the 8th century. These works are clearly apologetic in tone and are considered in SAID. Separation and its discontents, Chapter 7, so the Khazar theory is wrong. On the other hand, recent data on intermarriage indicate the potential for a greater degree of genetic admixture between Jews and Gentiles than in the past. These findings are discussed in Culture of Critique, Chapter 8. 3. On the other hand, those forced to convert to Christianity were disproportionately wealthy. Many of these converts became crypto-Jews, Muranos, that is, and they and their descendants persisted in their Judaism for several centuries thereafter. See discussions in Chapter 5 and SAID Chapter 6 and 7. 4. The conflict between group and individual interests is a fundamental one in Jewish communities, discussed throughout this volume. Conflict between group and individual interests. We've already seen that poorer Jews were disproportionately likely to leave the group, presumably because their individual interests conflicted with group membership. There is also evidence that intermarriage following religious conversion occasionally occurred within the highest stratum of the Gentile population. For traditional Poland, see Beauvoir, 1986-89, For pre-19th century England, see Bermont, 1971, 14. These individual Jews have clearly defected from group strategy to pursue individually adaptive strategies. 5. Baron, 1952b, 222, recounts the Talmudic story in which Rabbi Ammi, A-M-M-I, or Ami, discovered such a deception and took credit for saving the bastard from an untimely early death. The bastard was advised to marry a Gentile slave so that the offspring would be a slave who, upon liberation, could become a Jew. However, being a descendant of a slave was also a profound blot on one's genealogy. And so that ends chapter 2, basically showing that Jews are in fact genetically distinct from the goyim they live among, and they are in fact genetically very similar. Unity was even used with Jews at different places around the world. All right, that'll do it for today. Thanks for being with me. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples by Kevin MacDonald. Find it and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again for more MacDonald real soon.